Oh yeah, we will talk about interest rates, but also the Russian economy, infant formula, and the future of cities. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Baltimore, I'm Amy Scott, in for Kai Rizdahl. It's Monday, May 2nd. Good to have you with us. We've been talking about it, and markets have been bracing for it for more than 6 weeks now. And by it, I mean the next meeting of the Federal Open Market Committee, when Fed officials are expected to raise short-term interest rates for the second time this year. This time more aggressively, by half a percentage point. Longer-term rates have already been rising on government bonds and mortgages, and the interest businesses pay when they issue bonds to borrow money. Marketplace's Justin Ho looked into how corporations have been dealing with higher borrowing costs.
For the past couple years, borrowing costs have been at bargain basement levels. Winnie Caesar at CreditSight says a lot of companies have taken advantage by refinancing their existing debt, and by doing a little corporate self-care.
In terms of investing or doing some share buybacks or dividends.
As a result, some companies are thinking they've probably borrowed enough, says Chuck Tomes at Manulife Investment Management. And now that interest rates are rising, there's even less incentive to borrow.
So it is a more challenging environment for issuers to come to market and issue debt, especially the ones that are more risky from a historical standpoint.
Meanwhile, bond investors have been a little on edge, looking for any signs that inflation is cooling consumer demand and corporate profits. Jim Vogel at FHN Financial says companies that have reported disappointing earnings have been having a harder time borrowing.
And it not only makes it harder for them to borrow, but surprises in any one sector tend to hurt their neighbors as well.
Vogel says companies are likely rethinking any new acquisitions, expansion plans, or other big investments.
There may be new opportunities out there, but the cost of financing those big, major opportunities has gotten much higher.
And companies are eventually going to have to face those higher borrowing costs when their existing bonds mature. I'm Justin Ho for Marketplace.
Energy ministers in the European Union held emergency talks today about Russian natural gas. Last week, Moscow cut supplies to two EU member states, Poland and Bulgaria, because they refused to pay for gas in rubles. Fears are growing that Germany, Europe's economic powerhouse, could be cut off next. But Russia itself depends on its energy exports. Oil and gas help pay for as much as half the government budget. From the European desk in London, Marketplace's Stephen Beard looked into how the Russian economy is faring under Vladimir Putin's war.
President Putin has shrugged off the prospect of parting company with Europe's best customer for Russian natural gas. But, says Ule Valby, who's with the SEB Bank in Oslo, this is going to be, for Russia, a very painful divorce.
You can think about this as sort of like a 25-30-year marriage, you know. This is really long-term contracts.
Difficult and expensive to replace if, say, Russia wanted to sell more to China instead.
It takes time to build this infrastructure. It's massive investments.
Doubling the existing Russian gas pipeline network to China, he says, would take 8 years, cost billions, and still cover less than half the lost sales to Europe. And then there's the cutting off of supplies to Poland and Bulgaria.
Russia has sort of ruined their reputation, and it will be not many countries going into this new long-term contract with them.
So has Putin's war been an economic disaster for Russia? The immediate cost has certainly been huge, says Tim Ash of Blue Bay Asset Management.
Comes to something like $1.4 trillion of impact on Russia.
That's due to the stock market halving in value and the sanctions, which are likely to continue as long as Putin remains in power, extending the economic misery.
Less investment, less growth, lower living standards, probably a brain drain, just more difficult in general.
This isn't just a Western perspective. Russia's central bank surveyed more than 13,000 businesses across the country. And, says Elena Rybakova of the Institute of International Finance in Washington, the results were dire.
Almost every industry you take, they're having shortages, they're having difficulties to export their products to the markets that they used to export. Europe is the most important trading partner for Russia, and they're also having difficulties getting the parts for their production.
The Institute is forecasting a 15% plunge in Russian GDP this year. Unemployment's expected to skyrocket. But will this economic calamity undermine support for Putin and his war? It hasn't yet, says Nick Redman of Oxford Analytica.
That support would appear to be fairly solid. Right now, it doesn't look like Putin's grip on power is in any way challenged.
Nor maybe for some time. Whipped up by the Kremlin's propaganda machine against NATO and the West, the Russian people seem prepared to endure much economic pain. At the European desk in London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, go figure, really. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. As we just heard in that report from Stephen Beard, global events have a way of reshaping economies. Another example is China. It is still the manufacturer to the world, but in the wake of a trade war and a pandemic, many U.S. companies are looking elsewhere to get their stuff made. One of those options, Mexico. Marketplace's Sabri Benishour reports.
So there are supply chain problems, and then there are supply chain problems.
It used to take 21 days for merchandise from China to come to the port of LA or port of Long Beach and get to our warehouses. Today, it takes 159 days.
Isaac Larian is CEO of MGA Entertainment, which makes Little Tykes toys like Cozy Coupes. Those are the red and yellow plastic cars with googly eyes the kids ride in.
It's the largest U.S.-based toy manufacturer still standing.
So, back to the supply chain problem, 159 days to get stuff from China to here. And that's not even counting the lockdowns happening now in places like Shanghai.
So we have factories who make our product in the Shanghai area. Guangzhou, they open and close areas every couple of weeks. That adds to those delays.
He's also worried about strikes at U.S. ports. He's had problems finding workers here in the U.S. He blames tight immigration policy and the pandemic for that. Meanwhile, demand for toys has been raging.
We could not get labor. We could not get raw material on time. And that, then we decided, okay, let's go to Mexico.
MGA is keeping its U.S. factory, but in the past year, it's opened two new factories in Juarez, and it's about to break ground on a third. MGA is not the only one setting up shop in Mexico.
I think an increase is an understatement. I think it's more like a tidal wave.
Rain Mahdi is CEO of ZipFox.com. They connect U.S. businesses with manufacturers in Mexico. Most of what he's seeing is rerouting from China.
We are still in an active trade war. We do have 25% tariffs levied on almost everything we import from China.
Products coming in from Mexico do not have those tariffs. Shipping is obviously a lot easier. And there have been simmering issues in China that predate the trade war.
Intellectual property theft is one of the main issues for businesses who have IP. Counterfeiting is a big issue.
And then there are labor costs. Noel Maurer is a professor of international affairs at George Washington University.
Chinese wages passed Mexican ones sometime around 2014 or 2015.
China's economy has been developing quickly. Living standards have risen. Productivity has risen. But its wages have risen faster than productivity, Maurer says. And so even before the pandemic, there was pressure to start moving to Mexico. Northern Mexico in particular, where demand is now showing up in the real estate market. Omar Troncoso is a partner at the Mexico City office of Kearney.
If you try to find real estate for industrial parks or for warehousing close to the border, you won't get anything until 2024, 2025. Everything is sold out.
Troncoso has been helping a few clients relocate from Asia to Mexico and the U.S. And it is not just to supply the U.S., but it's even to supply companies back in Asia. He's seeing manufacturers who make things for other manufacturers also start to move to Mexico. It's creating a critical mass.
So once you have that scale, then the sustainability, then it's for the long run.
But Mexico's rise as a star of manufacturing could see it collide with another global trend, automation. Marius Fabre is a research fellow at the University of Basel.
robots that are installed in the United States actually have a strong negative impact on local employment in Mexico.
So companies that are turning to Mexico to save money and solve their labor and supply chain problems might, in some cases, also turn to robots to solve some of the same problems.
It depends on how automation technologies are going to develop going forward.
Depends a lot on politics, too, in both the U.S. and Mexico. We are at a moment of tremendous change in how and where we make what we make. And how it all shakes out will determine the fortunes of industries and economies for years to come. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
A lot of things that are in short supply right now aren't that big a deal. It's a pain to wait 10 months for kitchen cabinets or pay more for chicken wings, yes, but there are often workarounds. That is not the case for babies who rely on infant formula. 3/4 of babies in the U.S. receive formula in their first 6 months, the CDC says. And as Marketplace's Savannah Marr reports, many parents are having a hard time finding it.
For a couple of months, Deja Carson has had trouble finding her 7-month-old's preferred formula in stores in Richmond, Virginia, where she lives. She's out of luck online, too.
Even on Amazon, it's even sold out on Amazon.
This morning, she finally had some luck at a grocery store.
I just so happened to find 4 cans.
The infant formula supply started to tighten up last fall, says Krishna Kumar Devi with the research firm IRI.
There have been supply chain issues overall in the economy with respect to packaging, materials, and so on.
Then in February, a recall by Abbott Nutrition over concerns about bacteria hit the market.
The recalls just didn't help the case.
Davey says that company typically makes about 1/3 of all the infant formula sold in the U.S. Since the recall, he says it's been tough to find some specific brands.
You know, for products that you and I consume, that's okay. We can substitute.
But babies are loyal to their brands, says Bridget Young, who studies infant nutrition at the University of Rochester, especially if there's an allergy or intolerance to standard formula.
I definitely work with families who are driving 5-6 hours across state lines, having family and friends ship formula across the country.
Solutions that aren't available to folks who work long hours or can't afford to spend on gas or shipping, she says. So low-income families are being hit the hardest. I'm Savannah Marr for Marketplace.
Coming up.
And we did see pelicans covered in oil.
Yeah, not good. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 84 points, 0.25%, to finish at 33,061. The NASDAQ was up 201 points, 1.6%, close at 12,536. And the S&P 500 grew 23 points, 0.5%, end at 41.55. Spirit Airlines gave back 9.3%. The budget carrier has rejected a $3.6 billion takeover bid from rival JetBlue, which rose 2.6%. Spirit says it will go ahead with a planned merger with Denver-based Frontier instead. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose at one point to over 3% for the first time since 2018, before settling back down to 2.97%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Amy Scott. The world's cities have a huge role to play in preventing the worst effects of climate change. Urban areas were responsible for more than 2/3 of greenhouse gas emissions from 2015 to 2020. And in the next 3 decades, the UN says 2.5 billion more people are expected to live in cities, many of which haven't been built yet. Karen Seto is a professor of urbanization and geography at Yale and helped write a recent UN report on climate change. When I got her on the phone the other day, I asked her how we can design those future cities to be greener.
Cities that haven't been built are, in fact, right now,
primarily small towns and smaller cities. So when we think about all this new development, they're not just popping out from nowhere, right? Hmm. So cities that are already compact and walkable, it'll be important to make sure that there are high densities of housing and jobs. The other is for these cities to maintain the green space and the ecosystems that they have, because one of the ways in which urban expansion affects emissions is by, you know, taking over green space, by land cover change. That affects the local climate by, you know, putting in roads and sealed surfaces.
The report makes it clear that retrofitting existing cities, especially cities like LA and Houston that were designed around cars, can be really challenging and, I imagine, very expensive. Is there hope that we can actually do that at scale?
Absolutely. I mean, it is not a matter of having to completely redesign the city. And most of us live within neighborhoods, right? And so it's about making sure that we're, for example, building a supermarket very close to where there's a lot of housing. It is making streets more walkable. And you can make streets more walkable by putting in more street trees, putting in green space. It also involves retrofitting existing buildings, putting in green roofs and green walls.
Density had kind of a setback, really, during the pandemic, when a lot of people who had been living in cities wanted to move to the suburbs, wanted more space. Houses in the United States, at least, are once again getting bigger. Do you think that's temporary?
Oh, that is a really good question. You know, what's interesting is people are moving out of big cities, but it's not that people are moving into, you know, the countryside and adopting a agrarian lifestyle. People are by and large still living in cities, but they're moving from bigger cities to smaller cities. But there's no doubt that people are still wanting to live in cities because that's where the services are. That's where there's the amenities that people want, like restaurants, culture, museums, etc.
Many people have interpreted these reports as a warning that we're near or at the point of no return for severe consequences of climate change. And as someone who, you know, helped write it and has been living in this data, what gives you hope, if anything?
Well, I think the biggest source of hope is that 2/3 of carbon emissions come from cities and towns. And so if we develop solutions for cities, and if they were adopted by cities, that could possibly solve 2/3 of the problem. So that's pretty exciting. I'm also an optimist because we're adding 2.5 billion people into cities and towns over the next 30 years. And those are places that haven't been built. So we can use science to affect how those, all those unbuilt cities of tomorrow, how they're designed, how they're operated. So there's a lot that we can do.
What's a change you've made as a result of your work on this?
Oh, well, we are making these changes at our house right now. We have just switched to an electric vehicle. We have just ripped out our driveway, which was a asphalt driveway that contributes to stormwater and doesn't allow for groundwater penetration. We ripped that out and we put in a pervious driveway.
I started composting. That was my small but meaningful step.
Yeah, they are small. I mean, I am in a family of dedicated carnivores. And I will say that I'm not going to become a vegetarian tomorrow, but we are completely reassessing and trying to just eat more sustainably and really being aware of the food waste and minimizing that. So there's a lot that we can do at home.
Karen Seto is a professor at Yale of Geography and Urbanization Science and also one of the coordinating lead authors on the recent IPCC report. Thanks so much.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Hey, It's been almost 3 years since a massive cargo ship capsized off the coast of Georgia, leading to oil spills and fires in one of the country's largest coastal marshlands. The wreck hurt wildlife, affected property values, and damaged the tourism economy. Now Georgia's Glynn County has filed a federal lawsuit against a handful of companies involved in the shipwreck and its cleanup. Lily Oppenheimer reports.
That's the sound of crews sawing apart one of the last sections of the Golden Ray, filmed by local YouTuber Andy Jones, who spent his whole life on the water and used to be a commercial fisherman.
There was a lot of material that came out of that ship uncontained. Commercial fishermen locally were catching bits and pieces of cars in their net.
Over the last 2 years, he's gone out on his boat and used drones to document the ship being hauled away. When the ship keeled over while leaving the port of Brunswick, it was carrying more than 4,000 cars and more than 300,000 gallons of heavy bunker fuel. In April, Jones says he was still seeing debris.
Just 2 weeks ago, we had a bumper wash back up on the beach.
The suit cites the Golden Ray capsizing as the largest shipwreck in U.S. coastal waters since the Exxon Valdez oil spill in 1989. Crews pumped out most of the bunker fuel in December 2019. But according to the complaint, 44,000 gallons of petroleum products remained and started to spill out when the container ship was sliced apart. The suit cites one severe oil spill that lasted about 3 months and also talks about the protection barrier. A floating wall with a mesh net underneath. Its circumference was nearly a mile that surrounded the wreck. It had problems. Susan Inman is a coastal advocate with the nonprofit 100 Miles.
The barrier was minimal at times. Yes, it directed some of the oil to a specific spot where the mitigation crew could clean it up, but there was also holes in it.
The barrier was put up by a unified command tasked with the cleanup, which included the Coast Guard and the Georgia Department of Natural Resources.
You can't possibly keep every single droplet of substance that comes out of it within a confinement. I mean, especially with the currents that we have here.
Doug Haymans is a director with Georgia's DNR.
My personal opinion is that it did the best job it could.
But Inman and Haymans agree that the currents in those waters are remarkably strong and spread some oil past the barrier to nearby beaches and marshes. Inman says some of what the oil spill did was obvious.
And we did see pelicans covered in oil. We saw terns covered in oil. One of the spills occurred at the near the end of the chicks hatching. And so they weren't able to fly yet. So they go down to the edge of the waterway, get covered in oil, and they were not able to be recovered.
Then there are the things that were harder to see.
Manatees migrate through this area, and, you know, they're slow and cumbersome, but they also eat the grass. But you don't see what they're ingesting until they're sick or they're found dead.
The ship's South Korean logistics company was fined $3 million by the state's Environmental Protection Division. Inman says that's a low amount, because the marshes and estuaries in the area that were harmed are invaluable.
There is someone that has, you know, the definitive amount for all these injuries, but I have no idea what that looks like at this point.
County attorneys say they cannot comment on pending litigation. None of the defendants responded to requests for comment. Georgia's Department of Natural Resources is still monitoring nearby beaches to look for debris. In Atlanta, I'm Lily Oppenheimer for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out. For the first time in more than 2 years, New Zealand opened its borders to most tourists today. The country has been gradually easing what had been among the world's toughest COVID restrictions. New Zealand started welcoming Australians back 3 weeks ago, and now visitors from the United States, Canada, the UK, and more than 50 other countries. Before the pandemic, more than 3 million people visited every year, making up more than 5% of the country's economy. 21 international flights were expected to land in Auckland today. Okay, we got to go. No time for extra economic context today. Our daily production team includes Anais Amin, Andy Corbin, Richard Cunningham, Maria Hollenhorst, Sean McHenry, and Daisy Palacios. I'm Amy Scott. We'll see you tomorrow. This is APM.